From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I am prepared to run for president. That's what he told a reporter back in March. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, has defined himself by progressive values. He caucuses with the Democrats, calls himself a Democratic socialist. He's a big voice for even bigger reforms on the environment, the economy, income inequality. It may not have been a formal announcement, but the longest-serving independent member of Congress is certainly ready for a political revolution, as he calls it. And he thinks America may be, too. This hour, On Point, Senator Bernie Sanders joins us on 2016 and America's progressive future. Later this hour, we'll hear from two big strategists in the Democratic Party about the future of the party. But first, joining me now from Burlington, Vermont, is Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent junior United States senator from Vermont. He's chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, sits on the Budget, Energy, Environment, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. Before serving in the Senate, he represented Vermont's at-large district in the U.S. House of Representatives, served as mayor of Burlington, the largest city in Vermont. Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, John.
So, Senator, we hear that you're prepared to run. Do you intend to?
We're thinking about it, and whether I do or not really depends whether we ascertain if there is the kind of support needed to really bring about a political revolution in this country. If I run, it will not be a traditional type campaign. Clearly, I will not have the money that the other side will have. Koch brothers certainly will not be supporting me. But the goal of it would be is to engage working families in a political way that we certainly do not see today. Right now, the pundits predict that in the next election in November, 60% of the American people are not going to vote. 70-80% of working people, low-income people are not going to vote. Young people are not going to vote. And what ends up happening with the Koch brothers and the other billionaires spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, that's the kind of democracy that you have. Big money buys elections, working people don't vote because they've given up on the political process. Can we engage those millions and millions of people who are working longer hours for lower wages, who are maybe working in part-time jobs, who don't have any health care, who are disgusted by the growth of wealth and income inequality in America? Can we engage them in a grassroots political revolution? The answer is I don't know, but that's what I'm trying to find out. If I think we can, I will run. And if I think at the end of the day that really can't happen, I won't. But that's the question that I've got to answer.
Now, let me ask you one labeling question before we get to the agenda. And that is, you know, throughout the last couple of campaigns, Republicans have been using the term socialist as an epithet against President Obama. And he and his political advisors said, oh, no, that's ridiculous. He's not a socialist. He's a mainstream Democrat. Does that indicate that socialist itself is a toxic political phrase? And if not, why not?
No, I don't think it is a toxic phrase. I think what we have to do is define what we mean by democratic socialism. And one of the real concerns that I have is that the media does not do a particularly good job in general in educating the American people about what goes on in many other countries around the world. For example, if you take a look at Scandinavia, which on and off has had labor governments or social democratic governments, they are today, in many cases, providing quality health care to all of their people as a right of citizenship at significantly lower per capita costs than we do. And I think if you tell that to the American people, say, well, that's pretty good. They are providing free college education and graduate school to their people. I think the average American say, hey, I can't afford to send my kid to college. That makes a lot of sense to me. They are, if you have a baby, you know, in our country, you get 3 months off without pay as part of the Family Medical Leave Act. What they do is provide 6-8 months, half pay, three quarters pay, because they believe it's important for moms and dads to be able to stay home with their newborn babies. They have strong retirement programs. They have high-quality education. They do child care in a way that we can't even begin to do in this country. So I think if you explain, and by the way, they all have higher voter turnouts than we do. So I think if you explain what democratic socialism means, which is a government representing the middle class and working families rather than just the top 1%. If your question is, do I think we can get that message out and that people will respond to it in a positive way, I honestly do, John, because I think there is profound disgust now with the understanding that big money and their lobbyists determine almost everything that goes on in Washington today, and people want a real change.
For the average voter sitting around thinking, well, wait, isn't Hillary Clinton going to be the Democratic nominee in 2016? We've got President Obama now. How would you explain to them, here's the way I see public issues and what we, the public agenda, differently from Hillary Clinton, from Barack Obama?
Well, John, you know, A, we don't know that Hillary Clinton is running. B, if she does decide to run, we don't know what her agenda and program is. And C, I should tell you, I've known Hillary Clinton for many years, and I have a lot of respect for her. I knew her well in the Senate and when she was first lady. So my campaign would not be a campaign if I ran against Hillary Clinton. It would be a strong, strong campaign in defense of a working class in this country, a middle class, which is disappearing. And what I would be prepared to do, as I have throughout my political career, is take on the big money interests today who have so much power in terms of our economy and in terms of our political life. I think, John, it is fair to say that if we don't bring about a political revolution in this country, and that is to create the millions of jobs we desperately need, real tax reform so that the wealthy start paying their fair share of taxes, if we do not deal with this disastrous Supreme Court decision called Citizens United, which allows billionaires to buy elections, if we don't do those things, we are going to move, we're going to see this country, and I'm using my words here advisedly, move toward an oligarchic form of society where a handful of families, the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, a few others, have enormous control, overwhelming control over our economic and political life. And I am prepared to wage that fight.
But do you not already know enough about the politics of, say, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, for that matter, to say, yes, they see things a certain way. They are more in the middle, in the center left, whatever you want to call it. And mine is different. And if so, yeah, how is it different?
Well, it is different in that I have spent my entire career as a mayor of the city of Burlington, as a congressman, as a United States senator, in a variety of ways, taking on these big money interests. And that is, at this moment in history, exactly what needs to happen. We now have in America the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. It is obscene. 95% of all new income goes to the top 1%. That has got to change from an economic perspective, from a moral perspective, and from a political perspective. I'm prepared to wage that fight. Are some of these other more establishment-type candidates prepared to do that? Between you and me, I think not.
I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Paul on the line from Boxford, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on point with Senator Sanders. Go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, John. Senator Sanders, my question is specifically related to a campaign against Hillary, where you just said you wouldn't actually be running against Hillary. I guess my question is, from a corporation standpoint, Hillary has consistently been very pro-corporations, whether it be Monsanto or others, and where you would actually be running a campaign against Citizens United and the such, my question is, how could you run a campaign like that and not be counter to what Hillary actually campaigns for?
Senator?
Maybe you misunderstood me, Paul. It's certainly, you know, my views are my views, and they, I suspect, would be significantly different than Hillary Clinton's. But what I don't want to do is, the campaign that I'm running is not against Hillary Clinton. It is for the working families of this country, and it will be based on a very strong progressive agenda, i.e., I'm helping to co-author an amendment right now to overturn this disastrous Citizens United. We're going to be introducing legislation to create a progressive estate tax so that billionaires cannot leave huge sums of money to their kids and retain the kind of income and wealth inequality. I've helped lead the effort to protect Social Security against a massive effort to cut it. And in fact, we want to see Social Security benefits expanded. So my agenda would be a very progressive agenda. It would be based on the needs of working families and the middle class.
How high do you want to see the top income tax rate go, the top corporate tax rate and the top estate tax rate go?
Well, I can't give you numbers right now, but there's no question that it is a bit absurd that you have hedge fund managers, because of various tax loopholes, paying a lower effective tax rate than many middle-class people. It is totally insane that one out of four major corporations in this country pay zero in federal taxes.
A lot of Democrats say the corporate tax rate should go down so that our corporations can compete overseas.
Well, I'm not somebody who agrees with that. In fact, if you look, the confusion there, John, lies with what our nominal rates are on paper, and they're pretty high. But if you look at what the effective rates are, they're somewhere in the middle of the OECD. We have to, in fact, do tax reform. We have to make it fairer. But if you have one out of four corporations today, including some of the major ones in this country, like General Electric, like Boeing, not paying a nickel in federal income tax, that's a pretty absurd system. And by the way, as you know, we're looking at this inversion business right now.
Right. Senator Sanders, hold that thought. We're talking with Bernie Sanders on 2016 and the future of the left. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders, independent junior senator from Vermont, on the future of American liberalism and maybe a presidential run. Senator, I want to ask you to go back to what you said before about the benefits available to citizens in Scandinavian countries and extended leave and a much more generous social safety net. What would you say to the criticism that Democrats learned in the 1980s and early 1990s that there were limits on how far government could go and that to keep a Democratic agenda consistent with economic growth, you simply can't go as far as some on the left want to go?
Well, John, let me start off by answering the second part of your question dealing with economic growth. We all want to see economic growth, but economic growth doesn't mean much if 95% of all new income created by that growth goes to the top 1%. So you can have all the economic growth you want, but you'll still see tens of millions of American workers seeing a decline in their wages and a situation today where we have more people living in poverty than any time in American history. As to the first point, I look at the world a little bit different than many of my Democratic colleagues or some of the consultants out there, and this is what I think. I think that we do not create the kind of nation that we want, where all people are able to take advantage of the increase in productivity we've seen in recent years, where all people in the United States have at least a minimal and decent standard of living, unless we create what I call a political revolution. You are not going to do that, John, if 60% of the American people don't vote in all presidential elections, and with 70 or 80% of working people don't vote. You're just not going to do that. So the question is, right now when you do elections, you're gearing your message to a certain group of people. What I believe we have got to do is just engage people in a way that they have not been engaged in recent years. And the way you do that is by doing, in a sense, what FDR did, by identifying what the problem is. And I will tell you what the problem is. The problem is the extraordinary, unrelentless greed of the people on top who are saying that, yeah, I have $80 billion. That's not enough. I need more. And if we have to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and Medicare, that's fine, because I need more and more and more. And we got a basic moral issue that we have got to deal with. So I think that you change the political dynamic by engaging working people in the political process. Poll after poll tells me that there's no state in this country where people believe that you give tax breaks to the wealthiest people and you cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That is exactly what the Republican Party stands for.
Senator, let me ask you a question just about a small thing as an indicator of your thinking. As we were coming into this hour, we heard the news update from NPR, and it noted that the Dow was down triple digits, maybe as a result of some of the uncertainty over international events. Do you follow the Dow? Is that important? Is what happens on Wall Street and the stock market something that is a reflection of the problem that you're discussing, or is it relevant for average people?
Well, I think it's relevant for us all in this sense, that ironically, under Obama, who some of the Republicans seem to think is this anti-business, left-wing socialist radical, that under Obama, the wealthiest people in this country have done phenomenally well, and one of the reasons for that has been a huge increase in the stock market. But you understand, I think, that most people are not investing in the stock market. Most individuals are not. And as the stock market goes up, it primarily benefits the wealthiest people, not in all cases, but in most cases. The reality today economically is that real unemployment, as opposed to official unemployment, and this is the number that impacts ordinary folks, is close to 12%. Youth unemployment somewhere near 20%. African-American youth unemployment close to 40%. And most of the new jobs that are being created are low-wage part-time. Those are the issues that we have got to focus on. You could have the stock market going off the roof, but if it doesn't mean anything to ordinary people, what's the point?
Senator, I want to bring in another caller. We've got Matt on the line from Newington, Connecticut. Matt, what's your question for Senator Sanders?
Hi, John. Congressman Sanders, I'm a former Vermonter. I left in 2003 to join the Navy. I'm actually very excited at the possibility of you running for the presidency. My question is, how do you feel you can bring about a change with what can only be described as an impotent Congress?
Good. All right, here's what I think, Matt. And that's a very, very good question. And an area and a point that really differentiates me from, say, President Obama, who I have a lot of respect for, by the way.
I think he thinks the Congress is impotent, too.
Well, then that's the point. But here's the point. This is what I do believe. When I talk about a political revolution, John, implicit in what I am saying is the understanding that we are not going to make progress by sitting in a back room negotiating with Republicans. In general, that is just not going to happen. The way you make progress is when millions of Americans are mobilized and tell the Republicans, we understand what's going on. We understand that your function in life is to represent the wealthy and the powerful. That's not good enough. We are going to fight for a jobs program, rebuilding our infrastructure. We are going to make sure that our kids, when they graduate college, if they can even get into college, are not going to be deeply in debt. And when you mobilize people and educate people and organize people, the political dynamic becomes very different because you're not negotiating with a few people in a back room on Capitol Hill. What you're saying is that millions of people want change, they understand what's going on, and if you don't move in a progressive way, you're not going to get reelected. That, if we cannot bring that about, the political and future economic, the future of this country economically and politically, I believe is very dire.
Senator, before I let you go, I know you've just got a couple of minutes. I want to ask you about foreign policy since that's, of course, a big part of the presidency. We've got these two huge crises unfolding. Do you think President Obama should do more to press Vladimir Putin in response to the situation in Ukraine and the downing of this airliner, A? And B, should the United States do more to press Israel to curb its military action in Gaza?
The answer in general on both your questions is yes, but I think these are enormously difficult and complicated issues, John. If I had a magical solution, I would be really more than happy to give it to you. The one point that I would make is, you know, it breaks my heart, it really does, to see what goes on in the Middle East and people continuing to kill each other. I do believe the attacks by Israel and the innocent children and women who have been killed is not defensible. So I think we have got to do everything we can to bring a ceasefire. We've got to make sure that Hamas is not lobbing rockets indiscriminately into Israel, and I think the United States is going to have to play a much more aggressive role. In terms of what's going on in the Ukraine, again, a very difficult and complicated issue, but I think we just got to sit down with Putin. No doubt in my mind that the missile launcher came from Russia. I doubt very much that anyone's intention was to down a civilian airline and kill hundreds of people. I don't see what political gain there is from that. But you can't give, you know, people that kind of weaponry. And, you know, we've got to make sure that Putin understands that.
Should the United States continue to send military advisors into Iraq to deal with the threat from ISIS?
I voted against the war in Iraq, which is probably the best vote I ever cast as a member of the United States Senate. And you know, what has happened has been beyond disaster. It's been a horror. I think if we're going to, and I will vigorously oppose any more combat troops going in, but if a few hundred military advisors can improve the fighting capabilities of the Iraqi army, yeah, I would support that.
Senator Sanders, I really appreciate your joining us this morning. I know you've got to go. Thanks so much for talking about your potential race in 2016, and we'll be watching to see how it unfolds.
John, thank you very much. Take care.
Now let's turn to the big picture for Democrats. After President Obama, where does the party go? Joining me now in studio with a look that way is Elaine Kmark. She was one of the founders of the New Democrat movement that helped elect Bill Clinton president. She served in the Clinton White House from 1993 to 1997, where she created and managed the Clinton administration's National Performance Review and later was senior policy advisor to Al Gore's campaign. Today, she teaches public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings, the founding director of their Center for Effective Public Management. Elaine Kmark, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John.
And joining us from Washington is Bob Borsage, a big voice for progressives, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future, and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future, a progressive public policy think tank. Founder and board chair of Progressive Majority, an organization devoted to recruiting and training progressives to run for local office. Bob Borsage, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, John.
You like what you just heard from Bernie Sanders?
Sure. I think Bernie is raising the stakes on the debate, which is very important and, of course, fits where most Americans are.
Now,
most Americans now feel like something fundamental has changed in our economy. They want the country to pay attention to things here at home rather than abroad, and they are increasingly populist in a whole range of political attitudes.
Now, Bob, let me just press you on that for a second before I go to Elaine. I could sense a lot of moderate Democrats out there listening to this saying, whoa, wait a minute. We learned in the 1990s that the way of Bernie Sanders is the way of another Mondale, McGovern losing streak for the party. We have learned that Clinton centrism, which Obama has substantially reflected, is the way that Democrats can capitalize on demographic trends and stay within the mainstream of American opinion. What's wrong with that thinking?
Well, I think two things. One is the economy is very different than it was when Bill Clinton was was president. The Clinton years, the later years, were the last time we had growth that went across the political spectrum. Since then, the growth has all accrued primarily to the top 1%, and the middle class has been sinking. So we have a very different economic situation. And then you have a very different voting population. The Obama majority is made up of people of color, of women, particularly single women, and of young people. And those are the very constituencies that have fared the worst, both in the Great Recession and in the faltering recovery since then. And so they are looking for a different direction. So I think in both those cases, our demographic vote base and the reality of our economy, it forces a different politics.
Elaine Kmark, a different direction for Democrats?
Well, I think that it's a little bit complicated and there's a subtlety here. The Democratic Party in recent years has really lacked a growth strategy. It's lacked an economic growth strategy. And here being back in Massachusetts, I'm reminded of what Paul Tsongas used to say about the Democrats. He's the late senator from Massachusetts. He used to say, Democrats love jobs, they just hate employers. And I think what Democrats have to do is be very aggressive about a growth strategy, particularly growth that creates jobs. And that's where I think the subtlety is. I kind of agree with Bernie Sanders about Wall Street. That's for sure, and about the financial sector. And I think that even some Democrats have been too influenced by the financial sector. I would like to see them, however, more influenced by the captains of industry who actually make things, whether it's cars or airplanes or whatever.
Manufacturers, not financial engineers. Yeah,
I think there's a big divide in this economy. All the upside has been going to finance, and all the downside has been going to manufacturers. And once again, we are seeing manufacturers leaving the United States. It used to be that they took their plants. Now headquarters are leaving the United States. So I'd like to see a policy that's a growth policy that is weighted towards the pieces of the economy that make jobs. That's not finance.
Does that mean that Bob Borsaj is right and that the party dynamic including what we used to think of as its center or more conservative wing, is moving together on a new kind of agenda?
Well, it's probably yes and no. And as I say, there's a little subtlety here. I think the center of the Democratic Party is as rigorous and vigorous in protecting the social safety net from Republicans as ever. But the party, the center of the party, is a lot more cautious about redistribution and a lot more cautious about the expansion of government. And I think the center of the party would like to see a lot more attention paid to the management of the government, because, frankly, we're not doing ourselves as a party any good when we preside over one management fiasco to another, from health care to the Veterans Administration to these poor children at the border. And I think that we need to recapture the image of the Democrats as effective managers of government. We cannot go expanding government, as I think Senator Sanders would like to see, until we fix that fundamental problem. And frankly, in the last couple of years, it's gotten worse.
Well, Bob, before I get to the management part of it, are you heartened to hear that Democrats for the leisure class, as your old boss Jesse Jackson used to say, may be drifting a little bit in your direction at least?
Well, if they're now planting their flag on the other side of Wall Street, that's a good thing. I do think that what Elaine said has a lot of merit to it. But when you get to the question of jobs and manufacturing, you have to take on the trade and tax policies that have rewarded multinationals for moving jobs and reporting profits abroad to avoid taxes. And so, as Senator Sanders said, you've got one out of four of the major corporations paying nothing in taxes, and nothing outrages Americans and should outrage Americans more than that. And so this is not a question simply of let's get in bed with the captains of industry. This is let's make the government work for working people again, and that requires taking on the lobbies, both of Wall Street and of the big multinationals that have distorted our trade and tax policy.
Well, let me ask you about one specific. Senator Sanders said that corporate tax reform was not such an important priority. You hear a lot of Democrats saying, including Elaine Kmark, I believe, saying that we need to get the corporate rate down to make us more competitive, get rid of loopholes. Do you think that's a waste of time and energy?
Well, you've got to go after the massive loopholes that are driving companies to even move their headquarters and pretend to be foreign countries to avoid taxes. So we need a global campaign and national reforms to shut down global tax reform, global tax havens. But we also need to make sure that corporations pay their fair share here at home.
Bob and Elaine, stay right there. We're talking about the Democratic Party and its future. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about liberal values, progressive values, post-Obama. Joining me in studio is Elaine Kmark of Harvard's Kennedy School and the Brookings Institution. She served in the Clinton White House. She's the author of How Change Happens or Doesn't, The Politics of U.S. Public Policy and Primary Politics. And in Washington, Bob Borsaj, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future, a progressive public policy think tank. Elaine, I wonder how you think that Hillary Clinton is interpreting the currents in the Democratic Party and whether she, as somebody who she was always suspected to be a little bit to the left of her husband, but do you think that she, if she runs, will offer a different kind of agenda than we were used to hearing from Bill Clinton?
That, I think, remains to be seen. I don't think that she has been tipping her hand too much on that so far. As a senator from New York, she had a first-hand view of Wall Street. I would hope that that would give her the critical ability to make some changes that are needed there. She clearly has always been on foreign policy. She really has got her finger on what I think is wrong with the world, which is the way so many of these countries, which also happen to be the most aggressive countries in the world, treat women, and that I would love to see that made front and center in American foreign policy. Frankly, neither of the past two male presidents have done that, and I think it's about time we did that. So I think that she's going to have a very interesting take. I'm not sure that the divides within the party will be the same as they were in the late 1980s and 1990s, but I think that she's very pragmatic. She's very much a problem solver, and I think that that's going to appeal to a lot of people who aren't too don't like these ideological labels. They never have. And frankly, after the last 4 to 8 years of real polarization, people are really going to be sick of them. So I think she's going to come out in a very good spot on this one.
Bob, how does the prospect of a Hillary Clinton candidacy look to you? After all, she is the odds-on favorite if she chooses to run to win the nomination.
Well, it totally depends on how Hillary decides to define herself. She's free because she spent the last years in foreign policy to define herself very differently on economic policy, since she really hasn't spoken about it since the Great Recession. And that opens up the possibility of her laying out a much bolder agenda than that followed by President Obama and than that kind of adhered to by her husband. And I think that would be enormously in her benefit, both in the primary and in the general election. Any Democrat running in 2016 against a Republican Party is going to run an economy that does not work for working people. And they are going to have to show how they are dramatically different in terms of direction to change that if they want to get their own vote out. And if they want to
dramatically
avoid,
different from the Republicans or dramatically different from President Obama?
From President Obama, because you're going to have Republicans running on a quite simple theme. Obama failed. We're the change. Give us the shot. And after 8 years, after the Great Recession, where most Americans still will not have felt the benefits of any growth, you're going to have a Democrat's going to have to be a voice of change.
Let me see if I can get you to tackle a question that Senator Sanders ducked when we were on. Where would you like to see the top individual tax rate go, the top corporate tax rate, state tax rate?
Well, there's no question the individual tax rate has to go much higher. We have a
how
kind
much?
Of, I would say, we can start at 50% and keep moving up. Jan Schakowsky has a bill that would tax that would keep raising rates for millionaires and then 10 millionaires and 100 millionaires to higher rates up to 60%. I think that's a worthwhile thing. I think the corporate rate, the real question is, can you get corporations to pay the taxes that they're supposed to pay and close down the loopholes? But one thing that's clear is corporate tax reform, they have to contribute to the process of rebuilding the country. They can't simply do corporate tax reform that's supposedly revenue neutral.
Elaine Kmark, 50% and keep moving up for the top individual rate. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, I think that's probably not a good idea politically. I still remember Walter Mondale's 1984 convention, and I wouldn't go there. I'd keep the top rate where it is. I might do a certain.
Is that only a question of politics, by the way, or is there a substantive economic reason?
Mondale didn't say, I'm going to raise the top. I'm going to raise taxes on the rich. He said, I'm going to raise your taxes.
He said, I'm going to raise your taxes, but.
And that's a very different politics.
Well, it isn't politically. Politically, it ends up being basically the same. On the corporate side, I think there's a very easy solution. I think you put the corporate rate to where the 25%, which is where our OECD partners are, is currently 35%, the highest in the world. And then you get rid of the loopholes, which means that a lot of these companies that don't pay taxes now would actually pay taxes at 25%. And we would stop this flood of companies going overseas for tax inversion reasons. But I think the big thing is that a Democrat is going to have to say, I can create jobs. I've got a business growth strategy that's going to create jobs, because that's where people are most unhappy with the last 8 years is the lack of creation of jobs. So anybody who's credible, and to be credible on creating jobs, you're going to have some sympathy with business, with the employers and with the business world.
Bob, trade. Elaine Mitt says you have to have some sympathy with the business world. Of course, the business community wants new trade deals, the Asian Pacific Partnership deal, the deal that's pending in Europe. Is the right stance for the Democratic Party to say no more?
Well, I think the right stance for the Democratic Party is to take the stance the international community took right after the Great Recession, which is that these huge trade imbalances, where we have a deficit that's about 3% of our GDP, are destabilizing and they cost jobs. So we need a trade policy that moves to balanced trade. We shouldn't be continuing to do these trade accords where we're trading off jobs here for geopolitical reasons or for to isolate China, as in the case of TPP or whatever. We should be doing trade with a good Yankee sensibility that balances our trade so that we are not losing jobs in the deal.
But can you do that and still make trade arrangements, trade deals of the kind that they're negotiating?
Not of the kind they're negotiating, but you can do it and still do trade accords. Sure.
Elaine?
But the question is, what's the goal? You know, the president, I think, ought to lay out a goal of balanced trade. We're going to move there in 5 years. Put all the multinationals on notice that if you're going to sell goods in this country, you're going to have to start building some of them in this country, and investment patterns will change.
Elaine, it sounds like he's going after the heart of the new Democrat agenda.
Well, the new Democratic agenda was all about trade. I think that it's a lot more difficult to pass trade bills these days. I think that's only one part of what should be a much broader strategy to basically build a segment of the economy, the manufacturing economy, that actually creates jobs. I do agree with the fact that we ought to be making things here. And in fact, if you look at Germany, which has a very favorable trade balance, it's because they make things there. They don't do finance. And I think we've got an economy that's way out of whack, too much finance, too much growth in finance, and not enough in manufacturing. Tax policy is actually relevant to this, as is trade policy, as are things like the Export-Import Bank, which the Republicans are now trying to kill. And, you know, I'd like to go onto the shop floor of a Boeing plant and see how they feel if they had to compete against Airbus, which gets massive governmental subsidies from the EU states when they're selling airplanes.
Bob, quick comment from you on EXIM before I go to a caller. Do you agree with the Republican right that that's crony capitalism?
I think it's crony capitalism, but it's the part of crony capitalism that helps build some jobs here. So I've been in favor of it. But the bigger question is, we've now got, if Elaine is the spokesperson, the new Dems on Wall Street, we've got them on trade, and I think we can get them on public investment. You know, this notion that we're going to have the domestic budget down at the levels it was under Eisenhower is ridiculous. We need a massive program of public investment in areas vital to our future, in a modern infrastructure, in doing the basics in education from pre-K to affordable college. And that will require spending more money. We should spend it efficiently, of course. We should manage it well. But we're going to have the argument about more public investment and raising taxes to pay for that. And that's the final piece that I think is vital if we're ever going to have this economy begin once more to rebuild a middle class.
All right, let's take a call. We've got Dylan on the line from Austin, Texas. Dylan, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. My question is, how is the Democratic Party as a whole, or how are we going to effectively move forward with legislation against income inequality with at the same time escaping generalizations mostly made by the GOP and political powerhouses of the term, quote-unquote, class warfare? I mean, Obama's had so much trouble with that. I just want to know what the plan would be for, or how we could effectively escape that scapegoat, sort of thing.
Thanks so much. Elaine?
I think that a part of the reason, and thank you, Dylan, part of the way to do that is through tax policy. Okay, I think that part of the reason is looking not just the income tax is a very small part of this. Looking at all the ways we treat things, all the ways we treat capital gains. You know, on Wall Street, there's this thing called carried interest, which is just a big way that very rich people keep from paying taxes that are frankly income. There's a lot of ways that I think we can that the party as a whole could unite behind in dealing with income inequality. And I think the party can deal with the roots of income inequality. As Robert said, I think the party has to do a lot of public investment. I have to do public investment not just in infrastructure, but in education. And the party is, I think, fairly unified on that question. So it's sort of a short term, you can make some changes in tax policy. The long term is that you have to stop having this huge divide between those who have and those who have not, and the fact that they are then passing that on to their children through basically through unequal educational opportunities.
Bob, on Dylan's point, are you scared of the class warfare charge, or have we finally gotten to the point where people accept what Warren Buffett said, which is if there's class warfare, my side's winning?
Exactly. I think the thing that's forgotten is that both Bill Clinton many years ago and Barack Obama ran on raising taxes on the rich. The last part of Clinton's campaign
was significant. It's amazing how people forget that.
Yeah. It was significantly about taxing the rich against George Bush, who was opposed to that. And Obama spent the last weeks of his campaign mired in that debate with Joe the Plumber about that he wanted to spread the wealth around. So I don't think this is harmful politically, and it is certainly necessary economically. You can't generate the resources we need when we have this kind of inequality unless you're raising taxes on the rich and using that money to invest in areas vital to our future.
Bob, we had one listener post on Facebook when we were talking to Bernie Sanders, and the question was, are you for Bernie Sanders? And the answer was no. That's because I want Elizabeth Warren to be president. What's your view of what Elizabeth Warren offers the party and whether she is inclined to run?
Well, she said thus far that she is not running. I think there's a huge upswing on the progressive side of the spectrum, eager for her to run. There's a new organization out called Ready for Warren that just swept the Netroots Nation gathering with its spirit. And what Warren brings to our politics is a message and an attitude about fighting on the side of middle class and working families that she is going to teach Democratic candidates. They are going to learn from her because this is the message that will win. I would suspect that Hillary, when she finally decides to tip her cap about how she's going to run, is going to sound a lot more like Elizabeth Warren than she has in the past.
Well, let's get a little about that education from Elizabeth Warren from a banking committee hearing earlier this month when she was talking about public trust in the stock market.
Lack of trust in the stock market means less capital for growing companies, slower growth in the economy, slower job growth, and it means that fewer Americans have an opportunity to share in the wealth that's created by a rising stock market, and that further increases the disconnect between Wall Street and everybody else.
Elaine, does that sound like a message that could win the presidency?
Well, it sounds like a sensible message to direct some change. I'm not sure that it could win the presidency. You know, the fact of the matter is that we've got to take on this fact that we've become a financially driven, an economy that is driven by finance. That's where the growth is. And so I think that it's going to be a little bit complicated because you're going to have a very pro-business piece of a Democratic campaign here. And the pro-business piece is going to have to be very pro-business when it comes to things like corporate tax rates and keeping companies here in the United States, et cetera. That doesn't mean that you can't make some corrections between finance and manufacturing. But if we don't start making things here, making things in America again, we're in trouble.
Let's get to your point, Elaine, about managing the government. A lot of stuff blowing up on the White House right now. Earlier, the healthcare website was difficult. The VA is difficult. Do you think that this is a president? Are we seeing the consequences of what happens when you elect two senators to president and vice president and not people like governors who've run things before? Is that why this is happening?
It could be. I mean, frankly, it's a mystery to me because I know these are all preventable things. And these are not the fault of Congress. Congress is been a big problem in many, many ways for this president, but Congress isn't at fault in any of these latest episodes. There is a lack of attention to the management of the federal government. It's almost as if the federal government is an entity outside of the White House. And that's simply not true. You're in charge of this government. It is very big, but there are ways of being in charge of this. There are ways of knowing problems ahead of time and intervening. I think it's distressing to a lot of people to see the passivity with which this White House has dealt with these problems. And going back to our broader conversation, Democrats have to be effective managers.
Bob, is management as much a part of the solution as ideology is?
Well, I agree with the statement that Democrats have to be for a government that works. We want government to work, and so we have to be the big advocates of government reform, of government modernization, of administering it efficiently. But it's important to note the big problems in government waste, fraud, and abuse come from entrenched corporate lobbies and contractors and privatization that has ripped off billions and billions of dollars from the American taxpayer.
On that note, I want to thank my guests, Elaine K. Mark of Harvard's Kennedy School and the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Bob Borisage, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future. Thank you.
Thank you. Always a delight.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.